This isn't something we do every day, so I can speak for myself. It's nerve-wracking getting up here and doing this, but we're so grateful for the invitation. All right, so here's my story about family, music making, and proximity. When I was 5 years old, my family moved from Texas up to Canada. It was my father, my mother, my younger brother and sister, and me. We moved to Fredericton, New Brunswick, where my dad had a job at the university, and my mother was taking care of the kids, and she was learning how to be a photographer. And my old man also had a bad drinking problem, and so there was a lot of chaos in the house. He had a lot of trouble remembering that he had a family at home, and so the problems were happening every day around the house. But there was also a lot of great Canadian folk music happening around the house. Gordon Lightfoot, and my favorites, Ian and Sylvia. And that's where I would go for refuge. That's where I would go to escape everything that was going on, all the conflict that was happening around me. So, no surprise, the marriage didn't last too long. A couple years later, my mother packed the three kids up, got in the car, and we drove down to New Hampshire, where we started a new life and left the old man behind. And it didn't get off to a great start for me. I came down to have my shoulder-length hair, I had my little striped bell-bottom pants that my mother had made for me, and I was the only kid in my class with a single parent, and I was bullied constantly. And again, I would turn to music as my refuge. That was still my escape. All right, now there's a day that changed everything for me, and that was the day that we went to visit our cousins, the Cooks. They would spend their summers nearby in the country over in Lee, New Hampshire, in an old farmhouse. They were our favorite family to hang out with. It was five kids about our age and two parents who loved each other. Imagine that. And so this day we went over, and I remember it clearly. It was late August, and we were sitting at a wooden table under an apple tree eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. It was the eight cousins carrying on, drinking something called Zarex. It was a sugary syrup that you would pour in your water and make it taste like strawberries. So we're having our lunch, and my cousin Trigger, who was about 5 years older than me, he looked over at me, and he knew I liked music, and he said, "I have a guitar." And I said, "What do you mean?" Because up until that point, the only guitars I'd ever seen were on album covers. I'd never seen one in person. And he said, "You want to take a look?" And I said, "Yes, I do." So he took me up to his bedroom, and he went to the closet, and he pulled out a Guild six-string acoustic guitar, and he sat down on the bed, and he started playing the song Pinball Wizard by The Who. And I stood there, and I just watched him, and I just stared. It was my cousin. I've known this guy my whole life, and I've never seen anything like this. And he's playing music, and I knew in that moment that if my cousin Trigger can play music, I can play music too. And all the dissonance and all the frustration and all the sadness that I'd carried with me for my whole life began to evaporate in that moment. And music filled the air, and music filled my heart. And I knew while I was watching my cousin Trigger, that was something I could do, and it was something that I would do for the rest of my life. And I wasn't right about very many things when I was a kid, but I was right about that. All right. I'd like to bring my wife Claudia up to the stage.
Thank you. All right. Well, I have to say, I'm kind of up here, a little nervous. You know, it's interesting because as musicians, as artists, you know, we get up on stages and it's one thing, but I decided to take the challenge. Thank you, Jessica, for inviting us to be a part of this story share. So this is my story about family, music making, and proximity. So my family migrated from the island of Haiti, back in the late 1970s, and they came to the United States, and they landed in New Hampshire. That's where I was born a few years later. I was first generation Haitian American, and I was also the firstborn. So at that time, you could really say my household was Little Haiti, T-I-E-T. Okay, because in my household, we spoke Haitian Creole. We ate Haitian food that my mom made from scratch every day. We listened to my father's extensive record of Haitian artists. And I remember my mother, you know, she was a hairdresser at the time. And she had at the head of our dining room table a salon dryer chair. So women would come over, Haitian women would come over to get their hair done. But what it taught me from an early age was this was a place where women could feel safe, where they could gather. The dining room was a special place for me because laughter filled that space. But I had a tough transition. From that point on, I was moving into elementary school. And so I transitioned from the home to my elementary school, which was a predominantly white elementary school. And for the first time in my life, I felt very outside of my element, because life at home was one way, and now suddenly I'm at a school where people don't necessarily look like me. I have no teachers that look like me. It felt like no one was really interested in learning about my history and my people. So I felt I was struggling to kind of find my way. Where do I fit in? I'm straddling these two worlds. I'm American, but I'm also Haitian. And as many first generations individuals might know, you know, sometimes responsibilities fall on you hard. You know, I was there taking care of my little brother. I was also the translator sometimes for documents and papers that would come home, and the answering machine, if you remember that, the answering machine. I would be translating some of those messages as well. And, you know, life was tough. I was figuring out my way. And one day my mom and dad say to my brother and I, they say, listen, your cousin Carl is moving from Haiti to the U.S. and he's moving in with us. And we were like, wait, what? She said, you know, he's trying to pursue his education in music. He was a prodigy in Haiti. He studied with an incredible orchestra. He was a tremendous oboe player. And he was playing in different bands and different groups, and he wanted to pursue his studies in the U.S. So we were so excited, and my cousin Carl arrived, and, you know, while he may have been this prodigy back in Haiti, he was just another Haitian kid in Manchester, New Hampshire, trying to learn English, trying to escape the bullying he was dealing with, being teased for his accent. And so, you know, it was difficult for him, but he practiced this instrument. I watched this, he was like 6 years older than me, but his discipline, he wasn't playing video games. He wasn't outside at the mall doing all that. He was playing his instrument. And one day that changed my life in its entirety. I remember so clearly, we were at the kitchen table and my mom and dad said to Johnny and I, my brother, we are going to Symphony Hall tonight in Boston, Massachusetts. So get dressed. We're going to go out to Boston tonight. And I knew it had to be something big because we don't go to Boston for no reason. But it was huge because my cousin Carl was making history. He was the youngest to conduct the Boston Symphony Orchestra. He was also the first Haitian to conduct the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And we were going out there to support him. I remember getting my ticket, walking up those stairs and sitting in my chair and looking all around the hall, and every seat seemed to be full and people were abuzz with energy. And suddenly the lights, you know, they're down, the lights go up, and there from stage left comes my cousin. He's got his baton in hand and he's strutting across the stage. And I swear, it felt like he wasn't even walking on the floor. He was just gliding, and he had his baton in his hand. And I remember this thunderous applause that happened within the house. And I watched my cousin. I'm like, this is my cousin. This is the kid I'm hearing practice every day. He lifted that baton and there was a hush that fell over the crowd. And then he started to conduct the orchestra, the violins, the flutes. Everybody was coming in. And I felt like I was just floating out of my seat. And in that moment, the hairs on my arms were raised. I saw people closing their eyes. I saw my mom with tears in her eyes. And I knew that was my biggest hope, watching my cousin be up there, defeating all the odds. Here he was. All eyes were on him. The music never failed him. And he never gave up on music. And the music never gave up on him. And so then and there, I knew that this was a life-changing moment for me, and that music was going to be that bridge that connected my two different worlds. Because if cousin Carl could do it, I could do it too. Thank you.
So this is our wrap-up.
That was awesome, Nate.
This is our wrap-up. We go out, we're performers, and we go out and we perform, and a large part of our audience is young people. And so we try and keep these stories and these experiences alive in our hearts and in our heads as we go out, because inevitably, wherever we go, there's someone in the audience who hasn't experienced live music before, or hasn't sung a Haitian folk song before, or has never heard an interracial couple make music before. There's always something like that going on. So we feel like we do have a responsibility and a privilege, and it's an absolute joy to go out and remember that these experiences have shaped us. And it may be just another day for us playing songs, but for a young person out there, it could be a life-changing moment.
Yes, and we just want to say to you, to be human is to be musical. To be human is to be creative. And so we want you to just sink into that, you know, go and write that poem, sing that song, dance that dance, because you don't know who's watching and who you might inspire. Thank you.